Sciences Po.
Hello everyone and welcome to the new episode of Sciences Po Research Podcast, the podcast where I, Sergei Guriev, provost of Sciences Po, talk to Sciences Po faculty and friends about the work they are doing on the main challenges that our societies are facing in these turbulent times. And this is a third season where we talk about digital transformation of our societies, the impact of technological developments, the rise of social media, the development of artificial intelligence on political, social, and economic aspects of our lives. And I'm very happy to have with us today Ethan Zuckerman, who is an associate professor of public policy communications and information in the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. He's also a founder of Institute for Digital Public Infrastructure. He proclaims himself to be a tech startup guy, nonprofit founder, and blogger. He's been a director of MIT Center for Civic Media for 8 years, from 2011 to 2019. He's one of the leading advocates of freedom of speech online. He helps promoting participatory media in developing nations as well. What is most important for us, Ethan Zuckerman is the first president of the committee of stakeholders of our new Open Institute for Digital Transformation, the institute that Sciences Po launched on March 21st. This is a unique space. Our institute is a unique space where we have the European vision of impacts and uses of digital technology, the development of public interest technology, and the interaction between data analysis, computational methods, and social science for the better use of digital technology. Now, today we are going to talk about Ethan's work on freedom of speech online, on regulating social media, and on social media per se. Ethan, welcome to the podcast.
Sergey, it's just wonderful to be with you. I always love to be with my colleagues at Sciences Po. And what a treat to get to talk about some of this fun research with you.
Thank you very much, Ethan, and especially for accepting to join us, the president of Stakeholders Council. So I would like to talk to you about your most recent work. Literally, I actually looked up the data from just 5 days ago online. This is the work on the size of YouTube. YouTube is one of the most important social media in terms of number of users, just behind Facebook. Yet we have very limited understanding how big YouTube is. You have an answer to this. You can actually tell us how big YouTube is in numerical terms.
I can tell you the answer, but I'm going to tell you a story first. My son, Drew, is 14 years old, and YouTube has been central to his experience of growing up. His first dream was not to be an astronaut or a fireman. It was to be a YouTuber. I think he's given up on that dream now, which I'm grateful for. But it very much was how he learned about the world. It was the first search engine he learned how to use. It's often where he will go and try to figure out how to learn to do something new, to learn to play an instrument. And I realized that there's been a lot of study of very specific parts of YouTube. Here's how YouTube might be leading us towards extreme content, or maybe YouTube is leading us in partisan directions. But some very basic questions hadn't been answered. And at one point, he asked me how big YouTube was. I looked it up. I discovered that it's such a hard question that Google, for quite a while, was asking it for product manager candidates. You would interview for a product manager slot, and they would ask you to work out at a whiteboard how big you thought YouTube was. So I will give you the answer. YouTube is more than 14 billion videos. We worked it out through a way that is both very, very stupid and very, very clever. The very stupid part is we essentially guessed random numbers. It was almost as if we decided to figure out how many people have mobile phones in Paris by just dialing numbers that start with the Paris country code and then dialing completely at random. Internally, we call it drunk dialing. That's the method that we use. But we found some ways to do it in a scalable fashion, in a way where we could do millions of queries without damaging YouTube servers. And then we were able to extrapolate from a few thousand data points. It took us almost 2 months to collect those few thousand data points. And we then used that to validate a very old method that people had used that took advantage of a search engine bug. We thought it worked, but no one had proved it worked. We can now prove that it gets you a random sample of YouTube. And we use that now to maintain this website called TubeStats, which traces the growth of YouTube, but also really interesting questions like the average views of a YouTube video and what languages are represented on YouTube. And that's actually where I've perhaps been most fascinated about the research.
Yeah, I highly recommend everybody to check out this website, TubeStat, where there are languages, there are duration of videos, number of likes, number of comments, number of subscribers. Sometimes it's a reasonably sad reading. Like in academia, you know that majority of research papers have zero citations. And it is something like that that you can see in those statistics.
I'm sure that's never happened to you or me. And I say that knowing well that I have some favorite papers that have zero citations. Yes.
Yeah, but I think it's a very important question here, and we'll come back to this question. Google is asking this question when they have candidates for jobs at Google, at YouTube, but in principle, they have all this data available. They don't want to publish this data, but if I ask a Google CEO, in principle, Google CEO can give me exact number. Maybe it will be 14.5 billion, maybe it will be 13.9 billion, who knows? But he can actually have the exact answer, but they don't want to share that information.
I think that's correct. I think that we looked a little bit at the history of how YouTube has talked about its size. And they've talked about, you know, this many hours of video uploaded per minute, or how many years it would take you to watch all of YouTube. You know, all of those are sort of ways of saying, we're not really going to tell you. We're going to give you some hints, but we're not actually going to give you an exact number. They certainly have not talked about rates of growth. They certainly have not talked about where the growth is coming from. I think some of it is they don't want to make it too easy for anyone to think about ad pricing on YouTube. I think if you can sort of look at this and say, look, you've got 14 billion videos, you're only selling ads against this many, why don't you sell ads against all of it? Maybe that would change the ad business. I think some of it is just these companies consistently give us as little data as possible, and they don't like being under scrutiny. What's interesting about Google in particular is that they avoid scrutiny much better than all the other platforms. We've had many conversations about what's on Facebook. Do we have accurate data? Do we have enough information? In comparison, Facebook is actually quite transparent. They have a program that you can apply to. If you apply to it as a researcher, there are ways that you can make queries against it. YouTube has a way to make queries against an API, a research interface. But to do the sort of work that we're doing, to get a true random sample, to see what the average creator on YouTube is doing, there's nothing. It's impossible.
To what extent your data, which you've collected throughout the year, so your random sample of potential YouTube URLs can actually give you the evolution of YouTube, number of YouTube videos over the years. If you go back in history of Google, if you check at that year when they said that will take you so many years to watch all YouTube videos, would that be consistent with your numbers? You didn't
we could that? Try. That's a great idea. So what we do, think of it this way. At this point, we have perhaps 150,000 data points. We have the metadata associated with each of those. So we can look, and out of 150,000 videos we've retrieved, some very small percentage are from 2006, 2005, when YouTube starts. Most of them are from the last 2 years. YouTube continues to grow explosively. And so based on that, we can figure out how fast it's growing. But what's useful about it is we can parcel out the data set and examine it at different moments in time. So, you know, an interesting question might be, when does 1080 video become widespread, right? If you're looking at a YouTube video right now, if it's made by a competent creator, it's probably in 1080 format, the highest format. There's a point at which the highest format is 480. There's a point at which it's 240. We should be able to find that just by looking at metadata. But we could also dig in and look at cultural change of one fashion or another. Are there certain ways of presenting a YouTube video that change over time? In the history of television, the first television dramas were stage plays. They had microphones in front of people. They had static stage sets. There's a certain point at which the three camera drama comes into play, and you can watch the whole thing change. Part of what I would love to understand about YouTube is, are there emergences of particular formats? Can we go and trace through time where a super influencer like Mr. Beast, you know, sort of comes up with his format, and how does that disseminate itself through other people who are cultural creators? All of this is very consistent with something that we're trying to do with the Institute here, which is this notion of culture as data. And this project is really an example of what we're trying to do here. We can treat this set of videos as a massive data set, but much of the most interesting analysis comes from digging in and treating these as cultural objects.
Right. You're talking about metadata, which is indeed when the video was uploaded, how long it is, how many comments it's generated, how many subscribers the YouTube channel has. But indeed, the big question is, can we actually analyze the videos themselves? Now, we also analyze text as data. We start analyzing images data. I hope that at some point it will be easier to analyze as well videos as data, and indeed answer your question, how these videos actually are different from videos from the very first videos in 2006, which was wardrobe malfunction, I believe. And YouTube is culture as data, but it's also politics as data.
Yes.
And now you can analyze text as data and understand the sentiment and the bias in the text, whether it's right-wing, left-wing, extremist, anti-elite, discriminatory, and so on. We can also start to talk about image as data, and we talked about the work of Giulia Caprini, who is coming to Sciences Po in 2025, whose work is actually on identifying partisan bias of images on social media. That is a very, very interesting question. To what extent you think we already have digital tools for understanding the content of videos in an automated way? We already have sound, so in mm-hmm. principle we can do analysis of the sound of the videos. But can we analyze the videos as well?
Well, let's not trivialize sound, because there's actually an enormous amount that we can get from it. So start at the metadata level, mm-hmm. right? The format of a video is metadata, so mm-hmm. I should be able to figure out from the format, is it vertical? Is it horizontal? Vertical these days indicates that it was probably shot for TikTok. Maybe it was shot for Instagram. That's an interesting signature. It suggests that it was created by a user rather than created by a broadcast studio. That we can find out without opening the content of the video. Once we open the content of the video, the thing that we can do on an automated basis is detect whether it is music or not. That's very, very interesting. Is it a music video? Is it a compilation of clips? Increasingly, we can detect what language it is and then work on transcribing the language. Everyone is talking about OpenAI and ChatGPT. We're actually sort of obsessed with a product called Whisper, which is a very good language detection and transcription library. It requires a lot of thought to use it well. Whisper will listen to a piece of audio and say, I think you're speaking English, but maybe you're speaking French and maybe you're speaking Russian. It will give you a confidence level on each of these. We've done an enormous amount of work with human beings to actually figure out how to set those levels. So for English, for instance, you want to make sure you have about 70% confidence that it's English. You want to make sure that there's not 50% confidence that it's any other language. Then you can assume it's English. And then you might process the text for things like sentiment analysis, things like that. As we'll talk about in a minute, that also lets us separate the corpus. So I can use metadata to say, show me popular videos or unpopular videos. Show me new videos or old videos. Show me Spanish videos versus French videos. We also believe we can start doing image analysis. It's very expensive to do analysis of full video. There's simply an enormous amount of data. But you can grab shots of it and try to do analysis. We are recording this sitting at what looks like a news anchor's desk. And that's actually the thing we most want out of video. We want to know whether something is a clip from a news show or whether it is something trying to be a news show. It turns out that in English language YouTube, that's quite uncommon. It's maybe 1% or 2%. In Korean, it looks like it might be more like 20%. And we're trying to figure out why that is. Korean video seems to mostly be right-wing news. And we think this has to do with supporters of the president who was impeached using YouTube as their channel for disseminating partisan news. Being able to identify that looks like a news program, that would be a very simple binary classifier to build. You put thousands of videos in front of human beings, they say that's a news show, that's not a news show, and you have a categorizer learn what are the characteristics of a news show. It's got a chyron, it's got headlines scrolling on the top and bottom, it has someone in a suit at a desk. If it has those things, it is probably a news show. We will likely develop classifiers so that we can do that sort of classification of video, and that's sort of in the mainstream of what we're trying to do now.
Thank you, Ethan. For our listeners, none of us is wearing a tie.
No.
Even though we are sitting at something which resembles a news anchor's desk, which is a Sciences Po audiovisual studio. When I looked at your data about the identified language, I was a bit surprised. I will not say why. I would ask you if you were surprised to see how many, well, nobody's surprised how many videos are in English, but the ranking of other languages. Did you find something which you didn't expect to find?
It was enormously surprising. So first of all, we found much less English than we expected. YouTube is a US-based platform. English, I will not call it a global language. I'll call it a hegemonic language. It's a language that most people are forced to pick up because it's often a language of international business. English shows up at about 35% of the videos. It's quite a lot fewer than I would have expected. The number two is Hindi. And that makes sense when you think about the population of the globe and the fact that most Chinese users do not have access to YouTube. You would assume that in a world where everyone accessed this, Chinese would be number one, English would be number two, Hindi might be number three. We were quite surprised. One thing that's very interesting, now that we have Hindi language experts working with us, what is English and what is Hindi turn out to be very flexible categories. Both English and Hindi are very often spoken as second languages. So there are lots of pidgins like Taglish, which is part Tagalog and part English, which makes sense if you're in the Philippines, but you can actually understand quite a bit of it if you're just an English speaker. There are many pidgins between local Indian languages and Hindi. There are new emerging pidgins. A lot of people who have been fleeing Myanmar and find themselves in Bangladesh end up speaking a pidgin between Bama and Hindi. Hindi and Urdu have a very flexible linguistic boundary. So these first two languages, we actually have to be very fuzzy on how we identify them. We have to be quite generous. There are other languages that actually seem to have a much sharper language boundary. Spanish shows up third, and Spanish is Spanish. If you encounter those and you speak Spanish, you'll see it quite clearly. But it was very, very interesting to look at those top two categories in particular. Now part of what we're doing is pulling the videos apart by language. We have no good way of saying this is a video from France, but we have a very good way of saying that this video is from La Francophonie. And now we can go in and do analysis both on language and also have Francophones watch it and start making guesses. Is this made in Paris or is this made in Mali?
I guess you can also use machine learning for understanding the accents and indeed identifying the person's origin up to a region, department, province, village. Is that something that is doable right now or not yet?
I suspect we can get there, but it's interesting. You keep asking questions about using AI. What I've been interested in is actually lining up hundreds of human beings who can look at this. When we first generated this data set, what we did is assigned everyone in my lab 200 videos. And we simply sat at home and we wrote observations on them and we sent them to Ryan McGrady, who is our research manager, and he built a code book. And that's now what we're doing language by language. We look at a small handful of videos, we come up with some hypotheses, and then we try an enormous amount of hand coding. We have a hypothesis that Hindi speakers use YouTube more like a social network than a broadcast platform. Many English speakers, you know, are saying, hey, come click and sign up and subscribe to my video. I'm a YouTube influencer. Hindi users seem to be using it more the way you would take a snapshot of a family event and share it with your family. And that's what we see in the comments. That's what we see in the metadata and the traffic. We now want to understand how is that happening? And that's going to require both looking at the videos by hand and actually going and doing ethnography with Hindi speakers about how they're using these tools.
This is very interesting. In that sense, it's more like a WhatsApp group of your family and friends. And that explains why in your data set, median number of views of a video is 40 and number of likes is 2 and duration is 60 seconds. So that is completely different from big YouTube influencers who have millions of subscribers and views. And that is also something I would like to ask. When you go to TubeStat platform, you see the ranking of languages by number of videos, but you can also weight those rankings by duration of videos or by number of views. Would that give a different ranking, different structure? What you're saying about Hindi users, that means probably in terms of total duration of Hindi videos, it would be smaller. Total number of views, it would be smaller.
That's exactly right. So we are looking at this, and the first way we want to parcel it out is by language, because we think to really understand this, you want native speakers who understand the culture, who understand the context. We were talking before, we're fascinated to study Russian language YouTube. YouTube is one of two platforms in Russia that is comparatively uncensored. Telegram has been thoroughly undermined by Putinismo. It looks like YouTube mostly has not. We want to be sure. We want a much clearer sense. And in some ways, the way we will get that is by looking at this random sample of Russian videos and trying to get a sense for how it's changing over time. How is it different when we look at Russian language videos before the war, during the very beginning of the war, now in this sort of middle stage of the war? So we'll split first by language, then we can split by year or duration or any of these different things, and we can come up with a small corpus to study. Duration is very interesting because certain apps favor certain durations. 15 seconds was the default for TikTok for a while. Then it became 60 seconds. You will see in the distribution spikes at 15 seconds, spikes at 60 seconds. When you go back through time, there is a spike at 1 hour. There was a time where YouTube was restricting videos to only be 1 hour. Now the limit is I believe 10 hours. So you can look through all of these different things and see some of the technical echoes that show up within the data. For us, these are clues for where to dig. I imagine what we're doing here as using radar for an archaeological site. You scan the site with radar and you decide this looks like a promising place to put my shovel. But then you do that very hard work of unearthing the earth and shaking it through a filter. That's what the hand coding looks like. And that's very much where we think a lot of this work will get done.
Google usually gives data on number of minutes viewed by users of each video. You don't have access to this data, do you?
We don't. Mm-hmm. We don't. And there are terrific researchers out there building tools that allow you to do what we now call data donation. Data donation basically means you as a user allow me as a researcher to ride along. I can piggyback, I can see what you're seeing, do what you're doing. There's some very, very good work done with this. Brendan Nyhan and his colleagues at Dartmouth did some wonderful work that was able to demonstrate that extremist videos on YouTube are mostly watched by a very small group of people. And when you look at it, predictably, they are watched by extremists. So it's not that people are watching YouTube and suddenly becoming white nationalists. There are people, by the way, they're almost all men. They're almost all angry, racist, misogynist men. And they watch the vast majority of these really problematic videos. We know that because we were able to ride along and look at them. We are really looking at production. And what we would tell you from the producer point of view is that political content in general is exceedingly rare. What you find when you're actually looking at what people produce on YouTube, what you are most likely to get is someone live streaming themselves playing video games. You are likely to find someone doing their homework. You might find someone trying to sell their car. Maybe you'll find someone live streaming a church service. That turns out to be about 3% is religious content. So it's very different than how we think of YouTube. I use an example all the time, which is I say, look, is the purpose of YouTube to be an influencer? In which case, if you only get a few hundred videos, you've failed, right? Your goal was to get 1 million. Here's a video of my town's local school board meeting. It has 140 views. If that video had 1 million views, something very bad would have happened, right? Some enormous scandal is the only reason that could have happened. I'm very happy that meeting has only 140 views. That was not put up because they wanted to be an influencer. That was put up because of transparency. It was put up because of participatory civics. It was put up to make things more accessible. When you start looking at YouTube, not just from a world where we are all influencers and most of us fail, but instead you say, there are many reasons people create video. And maybe it is so that my grandmother, who is ill, can see the church service that she can't go to, then your understanding of the space changes radically. And what I would say is grandma missing the church service is actually a lot more common, we think, than people using YouTube to promote violent extremism, for instance.
Thank you very much. This is the famous denominator problem that you write about, where you're saying that we know number of extremist videos, we know number of political videos. So we know the numerator when we talk about political character of politicization of YouTube and other social media. But exactly your work allows to measure the denominator. The question is, if I just pose a question like, what is the share of political videos and not cats, not gastronomic videos, not church services, not school boards, What is the political segment of YouTube? Can you answer this question? How much is the presence of politics on YouTube?
We don't know yet. I think we will be able to give you an answer language by language before we can say it in general. I will say that when we analyzed a couple thousand videos by hand, it was exceedingly low. It was maybe 2-2.5%. It's clearly higher in some areas. It's clearly quite high in Korean. I think it's going to turn out to be very low in Hindi, for instance, but we'll find out over time. I think the other thing I would say, I'm very interested in the denominator. The denominator is sort of my response to all other social scientists. My friends always come up with a great data set and they say, look at this, this is fascinating. And I say, how representative is it? How likely is it? How common is it? It's not to diminish the work, it's to contextualize the work. But the other thing I want to provoke us on is what I call the quotidian web. And so if 2% of YouTube is politics, it's studied by serious people like you and me at places like Sciences Po, what happens in the other 98%? Because that's what people are doing as ordinary, everyday creators of content. We are getting quite serious about analyzing what does social media do to us as consumers. I don't know that we've gotten nearly as serious about what social media does to us as creators. What does it mean that everyone in society has the capability of creating and disseminating video? Let's be clear. This was a capability that did not exist as recently as 20 years ago. It's an enormous transformation, and it is changing us in ways that I don't think we understand yet. For me, finding a way to study this on YouTube, finding a way to study this on TikTok, this is a chance to start thinking about the quotidian internet and the internet from a creator point of view.
I agree. It's a major social transformation when people actually have agency on how they communicate to the world, the sort of communication that didn't exist before. And when we talk about agency, I would like to come back to your mention of data donation project. So in order to study YouTube, we want to have data which are available for the platform companies but are not shared to researchers even. And since we are in Europe, Europe has enacted a Digital Services Act. To what extent do you think this will change the game? We will understand better live on social media, including quotidian internet, everyday internet use as producers. To what extent do you think that is a game changer in terms of access to data by researchers?
Every serious internet researcher is fascinated by Digital Services Act and is watching the clauses of Digital Services Act that give researcher access very, very closely. I had dinner with a visiting scholar who's spending her year at Sciences Po, Kate Klonick. She's one of the best scholars around law and technology. She's spending her year here precisely so that she can look at DSA and DMA and think about these questions like researcher access. What I think is going to happen is that the companies are going to try to give out very little data. Researchers are going to challenge and go to the regulator and say, we need much more data. Regulators are going to demand certain amounts of data. Companies are going to go to court. We're looking at a long process. We're probably looking at a couple of years before we understand what the state of play will be around DSA. What is great, though, is that DSA establishes this idea that we users have a right to data to make sure that platforms are complying with DSA. And because DSA is so broad, it covers aspects of competition, it covers aspects of algorithmic fairness, it gives us enormous amounts to work with. I have a hypothesis that I'm trying to test that YouTube will drag you back to English no matter what you do. You start in French, you're accessing from Paris, you will get English language videos in there. I think, again, it's a great example of linguistic hegemony, and I actually think it's worth examining and testing. I can imagine DSA giving us the mechanism to demand a sample like the one that we created. But here's the piece I want to be very careful about. I would argue that I have a right to study YouTube this way. This is all public data that I'm accessing. I am accessing a lot of it, and I'm probably creating a load on YouTube servers, although, like I said, I'm very polite. I try to do it slowly. I'm very patient. I do it over the course of many months. But I would argue that that unpermissioned research is something we need to defend, even as we get very good at demanding information under DSA and DMA, the permissioned research that will come from getting the data from the platforms. Yes, I would love it if YouTube would do my work for me. If they would release a million purely random videos every month with certain research conditions on it, my life would be much easier. I could put certain servers and turn them off and not worry about it anymore. But I am not going to wait 4 years for that to get decided in the courts. I am going to assert my right to study YouTube that way, TikTok that way, and go ahead and share that data with other researchers who can ask and answer questions around this.
Thanks. As we know, Twitter actually did give researchers access exactly to that, a random sample of tweets. Twitter had an API available for researchers. Now, with the change in leadership, we actually have an interesting new development where at some point Elon Musk has published Twitter's algorithm, access algorithm, which was probably oversimplified, but still, sometimes you have differences in platforms' approaches to transparency. Since you're so much focused on humans studying social media, this question of whether YouTube drags you somewhere, in principle, can be studied automatically. You can create bots which will watch YouTube videos and see where YouTube algorithm will drag them to. Would you think that is a legitimate research? It's non-permission. It doesn't seem to violate any regulation, neither in the US nor in Europe. Do you think this kind of research is going on already?
It is going on already. There's a wonderful video, I would commend it to you and to any of your listeners, done by the Wall Street Journal analyzing TikTok's algorithm. They bought 100 new phones. They set them up with a location, and they wrote a very simple bot for each one of them. Each account had a name, an age, a location, and it had a personality. So one would only follow football and skiing. One would only follow fashion and dance. One followed depression and sadness. And what's very interesting is no matter the topic, within about an hour of use of TikTok, they all managed to get a feed that was about 95% matching that content. And so you can imagine for something like depression, this gets very, very tricky. You end up with a feed very, very quickly that could be dragging someone in a very dark place. TikTok, of course, had said humans don't behave that way. They check all sorts of things. We're highly random. The Wall Street Journal's methodology is very, very solid. It's hard to do this research well. There are hundreds of papers out there trying to analyze the YouTube recommendation algorithm. They all have problems. Many of them only look at popular videos. And it's possible that the algorithm works very differently when you start from random videos like ours. Most of them don't consider language. It looks like remaining in the same language is one of the major factors YouTube follows. Finally, most of them don't bother changing the country that you're coming from. When we're doing this research, we're starting from random videos, we're checking from different languages, and then we're using VPNs to get to the correct country to start from. So, for instance, when we're studying Russian videos, we can't get into Russia right now, But we can get into Kazakhstan, we can get into Latvia. Those are two reasonable countries from which to be looking at something in Russian. And then we can look to see, will YouTube keep us in Russian? Will it try to switch us somewhere else?
Thank you very much for reminding this, that this is not just a technological domain of research. Social context matter, societies matter, and in that sense, looking at issues that you mentioned, language, cultural context, that needs to be looked at, because probably both TikTok and YouTube take that into account for profit-making purposes. And in that sense, it's cooperation between computer scientists and data scientists on one hand and social scientists on the other hand is essential. And that's exactly what our Open Institute of Digital Transformation is going to do. Among its projects, there is actually algorithm Autopsy Lab, which is going to look exactly at those issues. And I would like to thank you once again, Ethan, for coming to this podcast, but more importantly, for joining us as a president of Stakeholders Council for our new institute. Thank you very much.
I am tremendously excited, Sergey. Thank you so much for the chance to talk about this research. But more than that, thanks for a chance to spend more time with Sion's Po. This is just one of my favorite places. Wonderful, wonderful work being done here, and it's just great to be a part of it.
Thank you. Science. Science.